Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the Salieri Report Anne Williamson, who is a world-class investigative reporter. She's written for many of the top papers, Wall Street Journal, World Net Daily. She's the author of a wonderful book on Russia in the 90s, Contagion, and events in Eastern Europe during that period. We had her on last in the fourth quarter of 2014, and there's been tremendous popular demand to get her back. I should also mention that Anne wrote a series for World Net Daily on global financial institutions and has a marvelous ability to sort of understand the interactions of politics and finance at the global, and she can certainly talk local level. She's in Budapest right now, where she's agreed to come in and talk with us from, and she's in the process of starting her own media venture, which we're all very excited about. The idea of having Anne cover global politics on a regular basis is very exciting for all of us looking for good intel from the ground. So, Anne Williamson, welcome back to the Salieri Report.
Well, thank you, Catherine. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, last time you gave us a wonderful briefing on the run-up to the events going on in the UK and in Russia, and I certainly have any of the listeners haven't listened to it, I strongly recommend it. But I want to come up and talk about the present day. You're in Eastern Europe now. How about telling us what do you think is going on in Ukraine now? Where do you think things sit?
Well, it's only gotten more complicated, of course, because the United States did succeed in destabilizing the region and retaining the coup government, though that's actually an inaccurate statement in that there were elections last May that brought Mr. Poroshenko to power. But those were they were not fully participatory elections because the East did not participate, did not vote. But at any rate, they did have elections. So this is no longer the coup government, but Mr. Poroshenko's government, which has many of the same members as the coup government did. But there is that difference that there was an attempt at an election. But the problem is Mr. Poroshenko is one of the oligarchs who's been robbing the Ukraine for years. And now he's in conflict with other oligarchs. And this is highly amusing to me, even though it's a tragedy, because the United States, once again, does not know what it is doing, with whom it is doing it, and what it's going to get. So now you have this struggle between two oligarchs, Mr. Poroshenko, who has the presidency, and another man, Masoysky, who has control of Urknaftigaz and Urknaftitransgaz, which is the principal Ukrainian gas supplier and the gas transit system. It's hard to say which is more valuable. I would imagine the transit system at this point. But right. At any rate, so we have that conflict going on, and the United States really, it's having to side with Mr. Poroshenko because he is the elected leader or the quasi-elected leader. But at the same time, he's already capitulated to Mr. Masoysky, who's back in command at Urktransnefteygaz. So where this goes, we don't really know because he's a very powerful oligarch that has his own private army. And that army is active in Ukraine. Now we're in down weather for war. It's winter. And my heart really does go out to the people in Ukraine because it's still cold here. It's still hat and glove weather. And Budapest and Kiev lie in the great European plain. It is actually colder in Kiev than it is Budapest, but it's quite chilly here. And I certainly wouldn't want to be living without heat or with reduced heat if I had to. If I could organize my life otherwise, I certainly would. So the people in Kiev and Western Ukraine are, if they're warm, and I believe they are, we'd be hearing more about it, it's because the Russians are continuing to subsidize Ukrainian energy, as they have done for the past 23 years. So there's that situation. At the same time, we're not getting very good reports out of Ukraine as to what life is like for the average citizen. We're getting lots of reports on government structures, meetings, movement of this official, that official, lots of rumor, lots of scuttlebutt, rather difficult to verify, but rumors are rampant. And essentially, you're waiting for spring when combat weather returns. And I'm very sorry to say that I anticipate there will be more violence in Ukraine, mostly because the United States is determined to provoke it, and they are supporting it with advisors. We know that. They're open about that. They're sending in advisors. They've sent in National Guard. They've sent in troops. They've sent in support technology. But they have not yet, to our knowledge, sent in lethal weaponry, though the Senate has voted that Obama do so. And let us hope he doesn't, because the Russians have already said that will be a game changer.
And when you say game changer, what do you think the Russians will do?
Well, I think it will be, you know, what we have to understand here is that in one way we're very fortunate, because we are dealing with a country that knows what war is. I think looking back over the last year, one of the shabbiest moments, the worst behavior, I mean, just cringing, embarrassing, horrible behavior occurred last year at the commemoration of the Normandy invasion last June. It was the first time the Russians had been invited, and I'm certain by the time of the ceremony in June, the other leaders were hoping that Mr. Putin would stay home. But as a proud man, the leader of a proud country, he wasn't about to do that. So he went to the celebration, where he was roundly snubbed. And that was one of the ugliest things I've ever seen, because quite frankly, if it hadn't been for 28 million dead Russians, there never would have been a Normandy celebration, or even a Normandy invasion. So that was really the social low to me amongst these EU leaders, that they could conduct themselves in that way. Now they're attempting to surpass it, because a group of them have actually suggested that this year's commemoration of the Warsaw Pact, or the Russian victory over Nazi Germany, be celebrated in Kiev and not Moscow. So, again, it's not understanding history or really what large parts of the world have experienced. And from the Russians' point of view, the worst possible thing that could happen is war. And Mr. Putin understands very well that his historical role is to modernize Russia. He is furious about having to spend money on the military. And an overly large, excessive Red Army was part of what brought down the Soviet Union, the expense of it. He's very conscious of that. And he even brought up this issue in his famous speech in Munich, his Munich speech of 2008. He spoke about the utter waste of spending huge sums on the military, and that the United States' intention to build a missile shield and station it right on Russia's western border would stimulate an arms race. Well, here we are 7 years later, and we have the same issue. So Russia is really being very disciplined. They are not responding to the endless provocations from the West. Now, they have been reduced. The EU is backing off from this because I think General Breedlove, who's the Secretary General or the presiding general of NATO, his remarks have really scared people because they're very belligerent, they're warmongering, and all this business of moving troops to the Baltics and this absurd exercise of a march of NATO troops from Lithuania to Germany through Poland and Czechoslovakia and so forth in some kind of Busby Berkeley Congo line of soldiers and tanks is really like a comic opera. Only, unfortunately, it isn't Gilbert and Sullivan. It isn't HMS Pinafore, and they are not going gaily tripping. They are driving tanks, and it's serious business. But the Europeans are finally, I think, beginning to see just how dangerous this is.
Well, clearly the Europeans don't want war.
Well, they never dreamed they were going to get into a war. Here was the bargain. I don't know if your listeners are like me, but it's really been a bit of a mystery. Why is the European Union going along with this? Why did the European Union get itself involved in this business with the agreements for the European Union Trade Association with the border regions of Russia?
Because you see, I have a bigger question, Anne, which is, I don't see how both Europe and the United States got into this pickle in the first place. In other words, I understand that the U.S. wants to be a hegemon on the Silk Road. I understand that the U.S. wants to keep Europe close and doesn't want Germany in bed with Russia. I understand all of that. But if you look at how insanely how they bet the ranch on controlling Ukraine, it doesn't make any sense. In other words,
well, yeah, go ahead.
Let's just say I'm the United States. And I want to keep space between Germany and Russia and Germany and China. The Silk Road flow is growing. I want to remain the hegemon. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And those are my goals, and I want to keep Putin checkmated. He wants a sovereign nation. I want to run the world through corporations and banks. We all understand that. But I want to keep him checkmated. If my strategy is just pure realpolitik and to do that, the last thing I do is I waste all my bullets getting drug into the mud in a firefight in Ukraine where there's not enough infrastructure on the ground to play that game. It doesn't make sense. You almost get the feeling, I keep thinking and I keep researching and don't have an answer, what are the tribal interests with financial interests in the Ukraine who've gotten us all hooked up here?
Well, first, to go back to your original question of why on earth get involved in Ukraine. Well, number one, the EU didn't understand they were going to end up focusing on Ukraine. They thought with the Eastern Partnership agreements, they would that this was a nice, benign effort, and that they'd start working with Moldova and Ukraine and Transnistria and Armenia, and over time reach these agreements. They did not appreciate that Ukraine is a special situation, because if they entered into an agreement with Ukraine, then European goods could enter Russia, because Ukraine has a customs union agreement with Russia. Those goods could then flow on to Russia tariff-free. And since Russia was trying to build a trade union of its own, that was going to be destabilizing to their effort. Now, Russia alerted Europe to this problem. and said, okay, if the Ukrainians want to flirt with you, that's fine, but we're going to have to work, the three of us, to pull this off, Europe, Russia, and Ukraine. And Europe's answer was, no, just Ukraine and Europe will decide this. Well, of course, the Russians didn't like that. And in the end, what Europe was after, you see, the only way Europe can expand is to the east. Now, that isn't really very important, I don't believe, to the people of the European Union, because the European Union, quite frankly, is big enough. It's too big right now for the institutions they have. They would be far better off probably letting some of the countries go and returning to a smaller union. Of course, they will never do that. But for the European Union leadership, expansion is the way to go, because that solidifies their position and it further entrenches the artificial institutions they've created. And they see it as the way to save the union. So initially, you had three countries pursuing these agreements. It was Lithuania, Poland, and Sweden. And this is very interesting because all three of those countries have invaded Russia historically. We look at little Lithuania today, but we don't understand there was once a greater kingdom of Lithuania and that they made it as far as Moscow and briefly ruined from the Kremlin. Of course, Poland has invaded Russia, and one of the pretenders to the throne was put into a cannon in the Kremlin and shot back to Poland, to the east, in the medieval era. And Sweden had very great wars with Russia. Charles II, he was a brilliant military man. Those were really great struggles. So here, centuries later, come the three nations to start these trade agreements on Russia's periphery. I mean, that meant nothing to Americans. But let me tell you, that embassy meant something to the Russians. And it's very interesting because Brzezinski's son, Matthew, is the U.S. ambassador to Sweden. So,
good heavens. Good heavens. So you would think they would know.
Yeah. Well, you think the U.S. would recognize, but the Russians certainly did. So, again, you have another one of these dynastic political families developing. And at any and the Brzezinski family is very strongly, they're all Polish nationalists. I mean, Matthew used to work at the Wall Street Journal, and he was very proud of showing off his imperial Polish tattoo on his chest, before tattoos were so socially acceptable. So that was kind of a startling thing when he was an editor there. But at any rate, you know, I can't really imagine a worse group of people to be given this job than those who got it. So they came in and they were very strong in their demands on Ukraine. And this was the key piece to the whole arrangement, because if they could keep Ukraine, then they were certain they could stop Putin and the Eurasian Union from developing. So, and at the same time, why do they want to expand east? This is crazy, because they're so big already, and big and unmanageable. Well, the idea is that they will then saturate those new countries with vendor financing. This will pull the EU out of the doldrums, create jobs, create a big credit expansion, and it'll all be wonderful. And by the time that whole epic is winding down, the United States theoretically would have Russia so challenged that the country could simply shatter into very consumable bits that then the EU could pick up bit by bit. So that.
So that you think the end game was the EU to expand, ultimately picking up pieces of more pieces of what's now sovereign Russia?
Right. But of course, had that scenario played out, I don't think it will now, but let's say it did, what the EU would have quickly learned was that the United States would be replacing Russia in the Russia-Sino agreement. So those parcels would never have fallen to the Europeans. They were just being suckers. It would have been the U.S. that grabbed them up. But I think that scenario is very far-fetched presently. Though that is still the dream. That is why they went...
Well, it's interesting that there are those who say that if you apply the oil card, you know, a low oil price and the financial sanctions for long enough, that Russia will, in fact, crater.
Yes, there are those who say that, but at the same time, who else is going to crater if you keep the price so low? It will not be. It's the same thing as pumping money, Catherine. They can pump money, but they cannot determine where the money will go. And we see in the West, it's all going to speculation and the markets. It's not going to production. So in the same... By the same methodology, when you attempt to punish countries, you may punish them, but not necessarily in the way you think, and not without harm to yourself.
Well, it's very interesting. Larry Summers just published on Bloomberg one of the most hypocritical pieces I've ever seen. I don't know if you've read it.
Yeah,
where he said that
paragraph. It's amazing.
It's amazing. It's, you know.
I was trying to read it before the whole thing, before the show, but I went, wow, this is news.
Right. If you and I were to make a list of the multiple personality disorder involved, we would probably have a list as long as the Encyclopedia Britannica. But but anyway, what, you know, what he says is the creation of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the Europeans coming into it, the American allies coming into it, is basically marks the end of the American era of dominance in the global, you know, financial and geopolitical system. This is basically, he declares, essentially the end of our, you know, the beginning of the fall of our power. So,
he's right, because what the U.S., actually, let's go back to this idea of EU expansion to the east, and what the U.S. was supposed to be doing in the interim while the EU consumed Transnistria, Moldova, Ukraine. The idea was that we were going to see the first digital siege of a country. In other words, we would choke off Russia's income through oil manipulations, through currency manipulations, through sanctions. We would take away her trade partners. And it really would be a 21st century version of a city under siege. And that eventually they would be so weakened, just as the medieval city eventually ran out of fresh water and food, that they had to capitulate. And that was what the U.S. was planning. And that's part of all this cybersecurity and cyber warfare they talk about. It's not other countries, it's them. And they are actually organizing digital versions of these very old, brutal war methods. So, but again, the U.S. makes strange mistakes. The first mistake, a lot of their mistakes are on the level of perception. They think everybody in the world wants to be an American and live like an American. And actually, that's not correct. It's most people would like to enjoy the prosperity that they see Americans have on television and in movies and so forth, but they wouldn't necessarily spend the money in the same way or pursue the same endeavors. You know, immigrants to the United States are often very confused by the culture. There's so many different messages coming in our politically correct era that it drives them more and more into their national enclaves where they function very much as they did at home but just with a greater prosperity. So, you know, that's one thing, this perception. Of course, everyone is absolutely going to be delighted to imitate or be able to imitate our way of life. So that's, number one, a wrong perception. And in the case of Russia, you know, quite frankly, they see a degenerate culture, and they don't want any part of it. They are Orthodox Christians, and they take that very seriously, despite the communist epic, even probably because of it. I mean, it was very strongly embedded in the culture anyway, but the oppression of the church in the communist era, if anything, only made its renaissance all the more inevitable and all the more important going forward. So there is that. And at the same time, they think, okay, we'll do this to Russia, we'll do this, we'll do that. They think this country is just going to stand there in place, you know, like some cardboard target. And that's what they have miscalculated, because Russia has been very active, as are the Chinese and India and Iran and other countries that have been locked out in the cold. They have been active. They are building these institutions. And another very interesting piece that I would recommend your listeners read, it can be read today on Lou Rockwell's page by David Stockman, or you can go to his DavidStockmansContraCorner.com and read it. But he gives a very clear explanation of what's been going on since 1971 in the currency and financial markets. And I thought it was very interesting because he dates vendor financing, and he's absolutely right, though I never would have said this earlier, from 1971. Because since that date, the United States has gotten over $10 trillion worth of goods and services from foreigners for which we have never paid. Now, that's on top of our own deficits and, you know, $222 trillion unfunded payments and promises to the public and so forth. But really, it was going off gold. Once you stopped gold, you stopped actual payment for goods and services. So we've been getting a free ride for some nearly 45 years now.
Right.
And that is coming to a conclusion. But why I recommend Stockman's piece is because he shows how powerful that was. And this is what the Americans sold the Europeans on. Look, you're going to get a chance to do what we did, vendor financing. So come on east. We'll take on Ukraine. We'll bring in NATO. You know, we'll get that Moldova. We'll get Transnistria, and on and on. Well, they're not kidding. Because already they have sent emissaries to Armenia, to Kyrgyzstan, and to Georgia to try and stir up more trouble. So they're not dissuaded at all by the events in Ukraine. They are still.
Well, it's very interesting. You have a model. You have a model. I call it the central banking warfare model. And, you know, what you see is anybody who can create debt, print, you know, in denominated in the currency mm-hmm. that they can just print virtually, is in a position to do this. The euro's been in a position to do this. The dollar's been in a position to do it. And what's been happening is you've been harvesting places, and you've been doing it in a way that doesn't necessarily create. You know, if you look at how the euro harvested Southern Europe, it basically mm-hmm. consolidates economic value, but it shrinks it. I mean, you're mm-hmm. harvesting, you're not building up. And the thing that's most frightening to me, you know, when I look at what the squabble between Putin and the U.S. and Europe, what I'm seeing is, you know, we've been rebalancing the global economy, and all these different players who've been trying to create liquidity out of the dominant central bank warfare model have been targeted. And now what's happening with the Ukraine is a whole bunch of them are getting together and saying, you know, let's create liquidity together outside the model. Now, I have a prejudice, Anne, and that is if you look at what's going on, I think, you know, if you look at the most powerful money in the world, it's saying we don't, the Americans are stalling all around the globe. We don't want to bet on them. You know, let's have a plan B with the BRICS. So I see Putin is getting more support from big money in Europe and the United States than maybe other people do. I don't think Putin is just isolated alone. I think, you know, I call him Mr. Global, the committee who runs the world. I think Mr. Global has decided to, you know, play the Hegelian dialectic, and they have plan A, and the Americans are clearly, I think, not able to kind of pull off what they've been up to. And Mr. Global said, okay, let's have plan B. We'll have the Asian Development Bank and see if we can, you know, get going. What Mr. Global wants is global government and global currency. So, and if he can control through the digital, right. And if he can control through the digital systems, you know, and behind the scenes, then plan A and plan B fighting works to his advantage. So that's my guess.
Well, but interesting. But even if we look at, let's take your model and add another piece to it, which I'm just thinking about it, because first of all, you have the Chinese who have created an enormous debt domestically.
Yes.
They're Keynesians. So I question the future there. I think ultimately China's future is very bright, but I do think there are some real roller coaster rides ahead for them.
Well, if you look, it's interesting. If you look between 2007 and now, 35% of the global growth has come from China, and that essentially all came from them levering themselves up. And you look at the numbers and you say, believe it or not, our big theme for the first quarter review wrap up publishing later this month is planet debt. I've been doing very in-depth studies on the debt system. And China, you know, if they've gotten where they've gotten since 2007 by levering themselves up tremendously, you have to ask the question, what's next?
Right. And that's where I wonder about the ultimate utility of these institutions in the intermediate term. Because if China turns down before they're solidly in place, then we're going to have a new game, not necessarily a better or a worse game, but we're going to have a new game. So,
right.
But I have absolutely no idea when that's going to happen to China. So it does seem all these debt questions are building also within the United States. I mean, look at car loans. We're back to subprime real estate loans. All of this stuff is going on again. And as I understand it, the levels have even exceeded those of 2007, 2008. Oh, and we also have the lending for the oil industry in there, the fracking. And those loans are going bad, of course, too. And they were somewhat similar to the subprime loans. So we've got a lot of debt in the U.S. that could go at any time, and China, which I really am not in a position to estimate when that might be, but it certainly does seem to be building. But who is not going into debt?
Russia.
That is interesting to me.
Yeah.
They have ever since Putin came in, and after the 98 debacle of the second Russian default of the 1990s, they have eschewed debt. They paid it off early. They even paid penalties in order to pay off their debts early. And they have been accumulating savings ever since. And that really was very beneficial to Russia after the 2008 downturn. And I think that double underscored Mr. Putin's commitment to staying out of debt. And now, of course, they're having to draw on their savings because of what the West is attempting to do. Yet at the same time, I see they are spending that money on highly productive projects. And they are spending.
Well, I think the thing that's got the United States in real trouble is if you look at the Chinese and the Russians' approach to You know, here's the question. Are we going to use the financial system as a battlefield? Or are we going to use it to transact business that creates income? You know, because part of the problem is, if you look at the central banking warfare model, it's steadily shrinking total flow. You know, it's shrinking the total economic return. It's consolidating and centralizing it into the players who can print money and have the power to kill with impunity. But it's not creating value. The pie's getting smaller. It's not getting bigger. And that's a losing game. And what's happening is you see the Chinese and the Russians fairly clearly signaling again and again that they want to put their money in things that make the pie bigger. And ultimately, everybody knows you got to make the pie bigger or nobody eats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really funny. I once went back and did a study of the Salem witch trials and looking at the legal issues in the Salem witch trials. And one of the things I discovered, you know what stopped the Salem witch trials?
What?
They almost ran out of food because everybody was going to court instead of going out and planting their fields. And finally, somebody got a hold of the idea, listen, you got to shut this down or we're going to starve to death.
Uh-huh.
You know, and you know, cooler heads prevailed. Mm. But the reality is you have a group of people who, you know, have been harvesting places and it's shrinking the pie, whether it's the members of the American middle class who, you know, are proprietors of small businesses and know you can't operate this way forever, or the Chinese, we're all looking at them and saying, look, you know, at some point we have to grow something or we're all going to starve.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I'm curious, but if you look at the speed at which the Europeans started to join the Asian Investment Bank over the last couple of weeks, mm-hmm. I think they're all saying, look, you know, at least these guys are talking about building the infrastructure along the Silk Road. We need to build the economy and to build growth, and we want in on the contract. So we can't fight. You know, the problem with Ukraine is you can't fight to afford, you know, fight forever. You have to go grow some food.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and right.
And so far, all they've taken is a huge liability. And that's what's really interesting in the Russian stance, is that they have shown from the get-go they understood that. Despite all of General Breedlove's announcements of Russian invasions of Ukraine, there's no evidence of it, and it hasn't happened. Why? Because the Russians do not want to take on Ukraine's problems. You know, they gave a very generous offer to Yanukovych before the coup. I mean, very generous. I was surprised at how much they offered. But they won't go any more than that, and that was leveled at $15 billion plus support for energy. Well, they have continued through gritted teeth the support for energy, but there's no payments on the $15 billion. That was shelved. So if the Europeans want this, they say, by all means, be our guest. But you have no idea what you're getting involved in, and they are correct. Because now they're dealing with oligarchical wars. These private militias could begin to fight one another. That's
right.
A very definite possibility in the
right.
This summer. And, you know, meanwhile, when I was asking about we're not getting much information from Ukraine proper, I mean in terms of what the Ukrainian people are experiencing. I mean, how is Granny getting by? We've got a lot of grannies in Ukraine, a lot of grannies who are alone. And we have young families, and, you know, is Masha able to continue with her piano lessons? Probably not.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Where are they getting their food? How are they living? You know, life, their currency lost 60% of its value. The economy halved last year. Since the beginning, in the first quarter of 2015, GDP has declined by another 15%. I mean, these people are suffering. So
right.
I don't know at what point the Western Ukrainians say enough is enough. We have plenty of reports of villages in the West refusing to turn their young men over for conscription. There have been some very thrilling YouTube presentations on this issue where some, you know, really tough Ukrainian ladies just let these guys have it. I mean, they're fabulous. And the entire village has organized and just, sent these people packing. It's fantastic. So we do know there is resistance. But how much longer can that government hold? Because what it is doing is so negative for the Ukrainian people. And surely by now, I mean, they were not demonstrating on the Maidan last year to become a member of the IMF or of NATO. That was not the point of their demonstrations. But that's how they've been offered. And we also have this fantastic example of the IMF really is becoming just a bank, because they're getting ready to loan Ukraine $40 billion. And the $40 billion is going to be spent on war. Now, you know, there is a rule in the IMF Articles of Association that no loans can be given to a country that is currently in a military conflict.
Right.
Well, they broke that rule long ago under Boris Yeltsin, because really the IMF financed the first war against Chechnya in 94 to 96. That was paid for with an IMF loan. And after that, of course, more and more loans were made, to the point where now they're making a $40 billion loan to Ukraine, who says it's going to build a wall along their eastern border, and buy U.S. armaments. So it's insanity. And this is no longer an assistance bank or a bank that steps in the lurch when some country's having temporary current account problems, you know, as it was originally constructed. That's long ago left in the dust. This is just a public bank, and it is now very much involved in war financing.
Right. Or financing sales for U.S. weapons manufacturing.
Yes. Yes. But, of course, you buy weapons generally to use them.
Although if you look at the statistics,
they're not going to warehouse those weapons.
If you look at the market share numbers, you know, there's a wonderful institute in Sweden that publishes military expenditure statistics. And last year, or the last year counted, it may have been 2013, global expenditures on military was $1.7 trillion. And if you look at who the exporters are, the biggest one is the U.S. with 37, but I think Russia is the second with 27. And, you know, if you look at the numbers on our debt problem, it's very simple. Our debt problem is a military expenditure problem because, you know, we sell bonds and then we spend it on weapons and military.
Mm-hmm.
So I think at the heart of this question is, can we find a way to compete on things that create value instead of things that just kill people and harvest places?
Well, you know, we have such an upside-down global economy centered on the United States. If you go back and you look at communism or Marxism as an economic system, it's quite clear what the problem was. And in fact, von Hayek and von Mises both wrote essays on this subject. I think von Hayek dated from the 1920s and Mises was 1912, but on why communism wouldn't work. And the essential point being that economic calculation was impossible. You couldn't determine prices in a system of central planning. I mean, to get it down to the very essence, that was the problem. You had all kinds of other problems, I admit it, but that was the central one. And where are we today? our economy in the United States is so upside down, and we have to have these less than, you know, zero-bound rates because we can't, the economy cannot tolerate a rise in interest rates or we'll go into an immediate depression. So all this talk about raising interest rates is just, you know, market come on, because if anything, we're going to get more printing of money. But why are they doing it? Because they are committed to a system and have been ever since 2008 where they will not allow prices to clear. So we're in the same boat as the Marxists, which I find...
Right. In a way, the Soviets, I always say the Soviets won the Cold War because we adopted the Soviet system. We're just doing it behind, you know, Glenn Greenwald's expression, the one-way mirror.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're just using the digital systems as a one-way mirror to basically control. You know, the Stasi never dreamed of the machinery that we've put in place.
Right.
So you can run, you know, you can trap the whole country with debt and then mm-hmm. use the digital systems to, you know, they're playing the economic hitman game at the, you know, with families that make $35,000 a year.
Well,
so
not only that, they are determined, what they're doing in this FATCA law, this new law that probably your listeners don't know a great deal about if they're living in the United States, but if they're expats, they know all about it. But this system is really designed to track every currency unit that is earned, spent, deposited, or borrowed in the world in real time. That's eventually what they hope to achieve, and they're well on their way. And, of course, this is the enormous control you're speaking of. And people just do not understand how threatening it is because, you know, people think all the surveillance is about, oh, they're, you know, they're going to know my – I wrote that naughty thing about Ronald Reagan, about Barack Obama, and they're afraid the government will come after them. It's just pointless because the government doesn't care about their political opinions at all. Their political opinions have done nothing to stop the juggernaut. They're
right.
quite comfortable. You can pop off all you want. Nobody's going to – as long as you don't advocate violence, no one's going to come after you. Oh, they might, you know, a few people who are prominent, whose opinions
right.
count with a large number of other people are at risk. But the average Joe, no. But if they learn that the average Joe has a older brother who married a Vietnamese woman and he learned to speak Vietnamese in the home in Kansas, with that Vietnamese wife or aunt, well, now they've got a Vietnamese speaker. They can go commandeer that man's labor if they need it in the future. You see,
right.
if you have all this information on everybody, you can now begin to sort the population to purpose.
Right. You can begin to harvest the human capital in ways most people can't even fathom.
Right, and that's really what's threatening and why these social media sites are rather threatening, because you're putting out everything you know. Maybe your daughter's a registered nurse, just all kinds of skills that they can then commandeer in the future. I mean, they really are dreaming of this totally planned society, which is like communism, and where prices won't matter. Because they will have so, they really believe that collecting all this information on the public and then writing appropriate algorithms will give them the power to overcome that fatal flaw of Marxism. And if we think.
Well, unfortunately, they're wrong. And one of the reasons they're wrong is, you know, markets do such a marvelous job of communicating and clearing the air. You know, markets can be have such integrity where they work. And I think that the problem you the biggest, deepest problem you have, and you see it in the United States and you see it globally, is this deep reaction to the perversion of it.
because any system that gets that centralized and involves as much hubris as this one, because if you look at the people who are managing it, they didn't come up a meritocracy. They came up something that went fast, brought in a lot of power, and there's a lot of simplistic thinking combined with hubris. And but it's also, you know, from a moral standpoint, it's a very perverted group. And
yes,
they don't believe in the law. They don't understand the power of the law. You know, they were basically, when the wall came down, instead of using the leadership of the Bretton Woods system to confirm and build their power, they used it to go on a global shopping spree. And were very piggy about it, and were way outside the law in, you know, in many, many places. And as a result, you've created a backlash. It's the blowback is not, you know, basically the blowback is against the perversion. And I always tell the story when I was sitting in Washington having a squabble with my attorneys during the litigation. And there was this chilling moment when I realized, you know, I would rather die in the wilderness than be part of anything that was this perverted, because there was no law. It was, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Dune, but if you remember Jabba the Hutt, this huge, piggy, grotesque thing, and you were dealing with something that just wanted more. It just wanted more, and it didn't care about the law. And it, you know, Leonard Cohen has a line I always use, we were blinded by the beauty of our weapons. This thing was not only out of control, but it was culturally empty.
Mm-hmm.
There was no juice to hold it together. And that's when I knew it would fail. And it was scary, because when you think of a failure that huge, it's just frightening.
Well, part of what they've got, you're right, they are totally lawless, which is something Mr. Putin repeats constantly because he's so astonished by it. And they're well outside the common law. But what they've got going for them is something known as administrative law. And that's what they use. And we have no control over that. And that's a real tragedy for us.
Right.
So, you know, they're in total violation of what you and I believe and see as the law, but we do not appreciate the power of administrative law, which has grown into a huge body of literature, of statutes,
right,
and regulations that control all of us. And this is what we don't have the tools to overcome so long as we have these huge governments.
Right. Because they can simply create more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's what really does worry me. I think a lot about these people, and I know quite a few of them personally. And, you know, I went, what? Why do they persist? What is it they want? Like you, in your conversation with your lawyers, it's just confounding. How could anyone actively pursue such destructive ends? But the simple truth is, these people think they're doing good, and they think they're right. I mean, it's that awful problem that, who's that writer? Lewis. C.W. Lewis, is it?
C.S. Lewis.
Who wrote so many wonderful books. The Narina Cycle is one of his, and so forth. But he wrote a great essay on, you know, the power of do-goodism, which is really the power to destroy, because these people believe it. Now, Paul Craig Roberts had an interesting take on it, which was one of the best expressions of these people's psychology that I have read, which is that essentially they believe they are the power of history. And it's so shocking and so frightening to think that this coterie of highly advantaged Ivy Leaguers are actually in that place, where they think they know all the answers. But apparently, they really believe it.
Well, this gets back to, because at the end of the day, their situation to me is a military question, and that is there sufficient superiority of surveillance and intelligence systems, of satellites, of control of sea lanes, of invisible weaponry that we may not understand or know about that can take them over the top? You know, so is there a military strength here that is invisible that you and I can't even define?
That's a very good question. But I question it. I'll tell you why. I read about so many programs that I had no knowledge of. I mean, a single day on the internet, you know, I discover 5 or 6 major efforts. Well, maybe not, but 2 or 3 that I was unaware of. And they are lavishly funded. And of course, we have the same personnel cycling through all of them. And the waste of the system is just extraordinary.
It's mind-boggling. It's here, here.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, waste, mismanagement, theft. It's over the top. I mean, it's ringing all the bells. So even though we have this tremendous military establishment, it is so fat that I can't help but think it's ineffective in the lurch. For instance, Russia only spends 1/10, and that's after raising their spending on military considerably. They spend only 1/10 of what the U.S. does. But if we look back to their defense of Ossetia in 2008 and Abkhazia, and the maneuvers they've engaged in along their borders since the Ukraine crisis, that's a pretty good military they've put together. I'm really rather impressed with what a good job they've done in just 10 years, because believe me, the Red Army was really down and out. So they've done a good job. But I think it's because, in part, they don't have a tremendous amount of money. They've had to be very disciplined. They've had to be creative. They've had to really train their troops. And you see, the U.S. Hasn't focused on those things.
And so what you're bringing up, go ahead.
Well, so we have this huge, lugubrious organization, this JABA, but can it fight? I'm not convinced it can.
This is a very important point, and I'll tell you why. If you look at the history of war, you know, the thing that really got war going was the bond market. Because the West came up with a bond market, and the bond market was the way you could finance a war before anybody had to pay for it. If you had to do war on a pay-as-you-go basis, you know, it's really funny, because when I first sat down, and I think it was about the third time I read Sun Tzu, The Art of War, I realized, oh, these were guys who had to finance with equity. You know, when you had to finance war with equity, you had to be much craftier and much careful. When you could finance war with a bond market, you could do Van Clausewitz. You could just go out and get a ton of money and buy a huge amount of stuff and overwhelm them with force. And the problem with that, and I saw it in Washington, you know, par excellence, the problem with that is you have no discipline to enforce optimization on the organization. And then everybody gets what they want. And you've literally got what you see in Washington, you know, the wall came down and then everybody wanted a peace dividend. But essentially the military industrial complex said, no, we want, you know, we want to, you know, we won the war, so now we want the reward. And they piled through after 9/11, and they've built an infrastructure. I don't know if you read the Top Secret America by the Washington Post investigators, who went off and put together a database of all the hiring and bureaucracies and spending and facilities. And it's basically this huge machinery that is just growing like a, you know, an enormous parasite, and it's overtaken the host. And of course, it's looking for something to do.
And it's really trying to replace the middle class that their economic policies are destroying. because all those guys are they're hiring, you know, are working for 40 to 50,000 a year, a lot of them, just middle class right. wages. I mean, they're not doing anything productive, but they are feeding their families and educating right. their children. So that's good enough for now. But ultimately, it's a wealth-sucking game because they don't create wealth. But they right. are replacing, slowly, a class of people that's dying. And right. somehow the government thinks this is all going to work. Well, I don't believe it will at all. It won't even work in the circumstances for which it was designed, which is warfare. I mean...
Well, it will work under one condition, let me argue. If you okay. can continue to harvest the planets with the games we're talking about, if you can continue to go around the world and destroy a place like the Ukraine and pick up the farmland and some of the businesses for cheap, and if you mm-hmm. can continue to do that globally forever, it will work. Which is why I come back to it's a military question.
But at the same time, we're seeing the world is beginning to resist, even in Europe, amongst the population. And now some of the EU leadership, they're backing off. I don't think the United States is necessarily going to get their sanctions renewed. Here in Hungary, Viktor Orban is in hot water with both the EU and the U.S. because he's standing up for his country. He signed an energy agreement with the Russians. And, I mean, what would you expect this man to do? His country needs the energy. He did the correct thing for...
Well, Exxon's running around Russia making deals to get oil cheap, so, you know. Right.
I mean, you know, and now you've got the Germans have taken a tremendous hit because of these sanctions. So have the French. Not as seriously, but German businesses... really impacted by them, and it's getting worse.
Well, there's no doubt the American game is going to have to change. It's just going to have to change. It's hitting a wall. It's hitting force feed. Before we close, let me ask you one question. What do you think the deal with Iran, let's assume it goes through, what do you think the deal with Iran will do to this state of play?
Wow, that's a really good question. This is actually the one policy of Obama that I'm very supportive of, that we get some kind of agreement. It's a totally fraudulent dispute because there's no intelligence that shows us that Iran is actually trying to develop nuclear weapons. And, you know, I remember hearing this stuff out of the Israelis that, you know, within 6 months, the Iran will have the weapons and so forth. Since, like, 1990, I remember them making these claims. It was always 6 to 12 months in the future. Well, here we are 15 years later, and they're still saying the same thing, and we still have no intel on nuclear weapons out of Iran. So at this point, I mean, I actually think they would be irresponsible if they weren't trying to develop them, considering their circumstances. But there is no intel. In fact, the intel supports the idea that they are not doing it, that they gave up any program for nuclear weapons in 2003. So therefore, you know, this whole this international association, why did so many people join it? Well, we've forgotten the other half of the formula, which is that that organization is allegedly committed to denuclearizing the planet. In other words, it's supposed to be working at getting the nations to drop their military nuclear forces. Of course, we have never seen that. That hasn't happened at all. That was just forgotten after they got the structure up. And instead, it's being used to target countries like Iran. Meanwhile, India, Pakistan, they develop nuclear weapons and nothing is said. So it's a screwy situation. But I don't think it will go smoothly in the same way that this reapproachment with Cuba is not going smoothly. because the Cubans aren't willing to make all the changes that the U.S. wants. And I suspect Iran will be the same. But if you can somehow undercut this Israeli warmongering, I think it's really to the world's benefit. And it will change the picture in the Middle East in a lot of ways, as will these actions in Yemen. I mean, the place is a mess. You can't even follow the players who we're support. You know, one minute we're bombing supporters, and another moment we're, you know, sending supplies to other supporters of the same movement. I mean, it's totally bizarre. I don't know how you can even. I mean, the teams keep changing flags, so it's impossible.
Well, I think what the world is saying, is look. The covert and overt warfare is destroying the economy, and we all need to eat. So we need to focus on more economic health and less fighting. And mm-hmm. I think the message to the U.S. is very clear. You know, you need to attend to building a life worth living instead of harvesting.
Yes, but do we have a single presidential candidate making that argument? Look, our front runners are Hillary and Jeb Bush. Good Lord. I mean, these are two people who are not going to lay down their banners. They're both war.
Well, if you want to really God, I know, you know, I hate suggesting more things to watch. I just, today I'm putting up a video from Eric Lee, who's a Chinese, is born in China, but moved here as a venture capitalist. And he did a study on Chinese and U.S. leadership. And if you want to understand the argument for long-term Chinese, you know, success versus the United States, it's really on the issue of what is the system internal to the country that builds and breeds up leadership? And mm-hmm. unfortunately, you know, the leadership here is oligarch pleasers as mm-hmm. opposed to real leaders. And if you look at the bench, it's not deep because, you know, you have people like Paul Craig Roberts and Donald Stock and David Stockman just writing cranky stuff all the time. They're so infuriated. But it's very painful to live in a country where you can't respect not just the leadership, but the system that creates and manages the leaders.
Well, so, the system in the United States has so gone off the rails because you have a Congress that absolutely does not function, except as a satisfaction agent for key players or well-organized players. And, of course, the public is always inchoate, busy with their own affairs. They don't organize, you know.
Oh, Ann, I have to disagree with you on that. If you look at the amount of money and time that's been spent mm-hmm. If you look at the amount of money that is spent to sabotage local political organization and activities, control mm-hmm. sabotage, I mean, I have to tell you, the German Stasi has nothing on what's been done in America. So it's very violent. It's very dangerous. So the American people have been up against it. Yeah.
I agree. But it is so difficult to pull all these disparate individuals together around a principle or an objective. It's much easier to pull together a bunch of oil men to defend their depletion allowance, you know. That's not tough. And you can get those guys to pony up the money and send representatives.
I hate to say it, if there's one group of people who could pull together the resources to get America back on the right track, in fact, it might be the oil guys or some of the oil guys.
Texas is now taking a hit, their economy.
Yeah.
And that's quite interesting because, of course, we associate Texas with energy. And thanks to the fracking revolution and the, Ford system in the south and up around Burke Burnett, their big oil plays were made. in the last decade. And at the same time, we should not forget that Texas also enjoys a disproportionate amount of the defense industry.
Right.
You know, the presidents make sure they take care of Texas because of all those electoral votes. So if now Texas is actually experiencing a true downturn, that's very interesting, because that means the oil industry is under stress, and so is the military-industrial complex.
Well, the independents are under stress, but remember that the large guys can recapitalize. You know, there's a long history in the oil patch of every time the thing goes down, the big guys consolidate at the expense of the independents. Well, anyway, so, Anne, I promised I wouldn't keep you this long. I can't thank you enough for joining us on this interview. Tell us where you're going to be next and how we keep abreast of your writing and your work.
Well, I've got to go back to the Caribbean at the end of May. And I plan to be in Russia in July and August, I hope, this year.
Oh, wonderful.
Interesting. Because I think we need, you know, it's time to get on the ground and have a close look at what's going on the other side of the border.
Now, I'm going to be in Europe in the fall. Are you going to be over there?
Yeah, you know, I wish I knew, Catherine, but I tell you, I take my schedule in sort of 3-month blocks these days.
Okay. Well, pencil in Amsterdam in October, because I'd love to see you. Okay, well, anything we can do to help, you just keep us on your dialing list, okay? And we wish you Godspeed and keep that good information coming, okay?
Thank you so much, Catherine. Thanks for the pleasure of speaking with your audience today.
Have a great day.
You too.